Secretary General of the Lebanese Hezbollah movement has blasted the U.S. for continuing to put pressure on Lebanon economically by blocking investment in the country. Bahrain's top Shia cleric Sheikh Isa Qasim calls for a boycott of Saturday's parliamentary elections in the tiny Persian Gulf Kingdom. And the United Nations Decolonization Committee votes to request an opinion from the International Court of Justice on Israel's prolonged occupation. Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to World News. Our top story, Bahrain's top Shia cleric has reiterated calls for a boycott of the country's upcoming elections. Sheikh Isa Qasim says boycotting the elections is a duty of all people across the country, adding that participation in the vote amounts to betrayal. Top cleric noted that taking part in the election will be the same as pledging allegiance to the ruling Al-Khalifa regime. The senior cleric stressed the government in Manama is putting pressure on people to vote in the upcoming election. Bahrain's parliamentary and municipal polls are slated for this Saturday. And now welcome everyone to the News Review Program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Lebanon's Hezbollah says that the resistance movement is unconcerned about the outcome of recent Israeli and U.S. elections, as polls do not affect the policy of Washington or Tel Aviv toward Beirut. Hezbollah Secretary General says all Israeli parties are similar in their crimes. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said he does not believe that there will be a withdrawal from or cancellation of the U.S.-brokered maritime deal between Lebanon and Israel, now that former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is set to return to power. Nasrallah argued the real guarantor of the deal is the power of the Lebanese army, people, and resistance. Referring to U.S. midterm congressional elections, Nasrallah said the U.S. policy toward Lebanon does not depend on which party is in power. Here he is.
The U.S. objectives are one, maybe they might change when it comes to how they lie, how pretentious they are, how, or their methods or their ways, or but in the essence, in their principles, they are fixed. And are the people of this region, we saw from none of these U.S. administration, from this great Satan, we saw only wars, we saw authority, we saw hegemony, we saw occupation.
Nasrallah said the U.S. is responsible for all Israeli crimes against nations in West Asia, as it was the U.S. who brought the curse of Israel into the region. He also blamed the U.S. for infesting Lebanon with Takfiri terrorists and creating an economic and political crisis in the Arab country. He said the U.S. continues to impose a siege on Lebanon by forbidding investment or economic aid to the country and relentlessly interfering in Lebanon's political process. And Nasrallah also touched on resistance campaign against Israel, saying regime has banked on the exhaustion of Palestinians, but young Palestinians surprised the enemy with their attacks on Israeli forces. He said Israel had also bet on the exhaustion of the Lebanese people back in the 1980s when it attacked Lebanon, but it was later surprised by the people's resistance. Now joining us for the program is Paul Lurdy from Berkeley, California, and Firas Al-Najim joining us from Ottawa, Canada. Hello, gentlemen. I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. Paul, I guess we'll start with you. Your initial thoughts about how much the West likes to portray as the impediment to the economic success of Lebanon is always Hezbollah. But Hezbollah always says that, look, it's the West that is always tying our arms. We can't get any kind of, international bailouts, any kind of funding into the country. We can't really do any kind of deals with any other country because of U.S. sanctions and blockades. Your thoughts?
Well, I would have to go with the assessment of Hezbollah in this case. And this is exactly the United States basically does whatever it wants to do. And in order to get it done, It pits various groups within a country or a society against each other. It can always find and purchase allies within a region. It did so in Afghanistan, and it's doing so in Syria, and it's doing it in Ukraine, and it does it in Lebanon as well. So they provide resources to those who will follow the dictates of the United States. This is the way the United States divides and rules everywhere, with plenty of threats and weapons.
Thank you, Paul. And Firoz al-Najim, I'd like to welcome. Now, Firoz, your thoughts on how the U.S. ties Lebanese hands economically, and so much of the hardship in Lebanon goes right back to the Pentagon and the White House.
Yes, I mean, this is just a type of strategy that's always failed. They did the same thing, with the Islamic Republic of Iran for over 43 years. So they're trying to tighten up the situation on the Lebanese nation to hoping that the Lebanese people will rise up against Hezbollah, and there's going to be internal conflicts and problems inside Lebanon. And this is just one of their strategies, that they have tried, and they have always failed in that. Hezbollah is a very strong force because of its resistance forces, their unification, how they're unified. How their leader is a great wise man, and he's a man that cares about his nation. He has released all the prisoners from the Israeli prisons by obviously arresting and prosecuting Israeli prisoners and Israeli IDF soldiers before, and then there was some negotiations through a mediation because obviously Hezbollah does not recognize Israel in any way, so it was mediated through Germany at that time. And they released all their prisoners, and they are the hope for the region and for the country, because they're a force that cannot be defeated and cannot be taken out in any kind of way. They have tried for many years. Israel is supported by most of the world countries. They have provided them all kinds of technology and intelligence and weapons, advanced weapons, and they cannot deal with this force inside Lebanon. Hezbollah also right now is obviously, today was the commemoration of the Martyrs' Day, and this is a day remembering all the martyrs that were sacrificed fighting this battle to liberate Lebanon. And Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah elaborated very much on the problems that with the Israelis and the Americans, and saying that no matter who comes into power in the U.S., the Republicans or the Democrats, it's the same thing, because they both by foundation, by establishment, support the Zionist regime and help them commit more crimes and empower them to commit more crimes. There's just different ways of dealing with things and different ways of proposing, the scenario. But at the end of the day, they both support the Israeli regime, and they're both criminal regimes, and that's why Imam al-Khomeini, the one that established the revolution of Iran, he said that America is great Satan, a shaitan al-akbar. And now today we are seeing that this label of U.S. is more clear to everybody in the world because of all the crimes they have committed, not just in Palestine, everywhere in the world. Everywhere they put their hands, everywhere they get involved and infiltrate, and anywhere they invade, they destroy the country and leave it in the worst conditions with the worst type of systems as well.
Is that what's going on, Paul? Is the U.S. policy here to put so much economic strain on a country like Lebanon that it implodes from the inside? We've seen this policy on Iran, on Venezuela, on Cuba, North Korea, recently Afghanistan, and possibly we could even add, as far as an attempt goes, Russia to that list.
Exactly. The U.S. loves chaos, misery, destruction, and uses these instruments to try to get what it wants when the people of the country want none of it. When a country asserts its independence and doesn't fall down and worship the United States and obey everything the United States says, then the United States will do everything in its power to destroy that country. And they've gone a long way in doing that in several countries. I think everybody listening to this report knows which countries we're talking about. And the only way you avoid that is by accepting everything the United States wants of you and sending all your riches to U.S. And international corporations. So this is the way things go. As far as Republicans and Democrats, there's no hope. There's no point in following this. This is Republicans, and this other side is Democrats. But in between, it's exactly the same. What's underneath, all you see is what's on the surface. What's underneath is exactly the same in both cases. And furthermore, they're destroying the United States as well. They're destroying the society of the United States. They're impoverishing the American people. And there are a few parties besides the Republicans and Democrats on the side who are doing something, who are advocating something entirely different. For example, the Green Party and the Peace and Freedom Party and the Libertarian Party on the right, the Libertarian Party on the right and the other parties on the left, they all are extremely critical of U.S. policy towards Palestinians and Israel and many other countries as well. But for Republicans and Democrats, they are the ones that enforce U.S. policy not only on the rest of the world, but also on their own people who are becoming impoverished as well.
And Firas, to Paul's point, the U.S. will continue this economic pressure on a country such as Lebanon until Lebanese accept what the U.S. wants for Lebanon. What does the U.S. want for Lebanon, Firas?
Well, they want a submissive Lebanon. They want a weak resistance. They don't want a sovereign country. They don't want a threat on the borders with the Zionist regime calling for the liberation of Palestine. That is the main point. They do not want sovereignty, and this is what it is. The big battle is that they want everybody to be submissive and following their orders and securing their allies and their puppets in the region. And this is not going to work with Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah has sacrificed his son Hadi Nasrallah, a great martyr fighting the Zionist regime, and he's willing to sacrifice everything for the liberation of Palestine and to live in sovereignty and dignity and honor. And this battle will continue until Palestine will be free. As Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said in his recent speech, that we do not care which leader comes into the Israeli regime, because they are all criminals, and at the end of the day, we're going to continue to fight them until we win this divine battle and we liberate all of Palestine from the river to the sea. And this is the battle. The battle is very intense, it's very serious, and it's going to continue until freedom is attained for the Palestinians and for all the oppressed people.
All right, gentlemen, thank you both for joining us on the program. And Firas al-Najim there joining us out of Canada, and Paul Lurdy joining us from the States. And that's a wrap for the segment of your news review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now. Welcome back, everyone. The United Nations Decolonization Committee has approved a resolution asking for the International Court of Justice to urgently intervene on Israel's occupation of Palestinian territory. The resolution also requests the ICJ weigh in on the regime's settlement activities and annexation of Palestinian land. The document says Israeli actions violate Palestinians' right to self-determination. The resolution was supported by 98 countries with 17 against and 52 abstentions. The Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki has hailed the development as a diplomatic and legal breakthrough to hold Israel accountable for its war crimes. The ICJ also ruled in 2004 the Israeli separation wall in the occupied West Bank was illegal. The European Union will soon enter recession, according to latest economic forecasts. Cost of living crisis in the 27-country bloc is set to last longer than first expected. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
The EU's executive arm, the European Commission, suggests the bloc's economy will have contracted for a six-month period up to the end of March 2023. This means recession. Inflation is forecast to stay high for longer than initially anticipated. Uncertainty surrounds the medium to long-term picture also.
The largest threat comes from adverse developments on the gas market and the risk of shortages, especially not this winter, but next winter.
As EU energy sanctions against Russia appear to backfire, business and consumer confidence continues to decline across the 27-country bloc.
We're very concerned, particularly for people that are on lower incomes that are very much affected by the higher energy prices.
I'm afraid that it can get much worse before it gets better.
The price of the energy is so high. The price of the products, I think it's a thing of everything.
EU leaders firmly blame Moscow for the crisis amid the conflict in Ukraine. However, some commentators claim the United States has used NATO to manufacture the war.
America is fighting against multilateral world, but basically is fighting against our freedoms, democracy, and everything it pretends it stands for.
The EU says it will continue to fund the Ukrainian army and government no matter what the cost. Back home, the only good news is that employment figures remain positive. Just modest damage to the EU labour market is forecast for 2023. It is an area that is being monitored very closely by the Commission, as there's broad consensus. A sharp rise in unemployment would represent the final nail in the coffin for the EU economy. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Western sanctions against Russia has backfired. Major oil and gas executives have warned that a real risk of a shortfall in EU lies ahead in 2023. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT wrote in this regard, the region is facing an unprecedented energy crunch following a drop in imports from Russia. The oil and gas shortages and record high inflation have resulted in an overall cost of living crisis across the EU. But while concerns are focused on the turmoil of the coming winter, it is the next cold season that they should really worry about. CEO of major oil trader Vitol, Russell Hardy, has said, "We've got a difficult winter ahead, and subsequent to that, we've got a more difficult winter in the year ahead of that because the production that is available to Europe in the first half of 2023 is considerably less than the production we had available to us in the first half of 2022," he said at a conference in Abu Dhabi last week. Energy prices have gone off the charts and are close to unaffordability, with many households spending 50% of their disposable income on energy or higher. BP CEO Bernard Looney has warned, agreeing with his colleague that the next winter in Europe could be even more challenging. Even though the EU has managed to fill its energy stockpiles by 90%, according to IEA data, the reserves are made up mostly of Russian gas. But as the bloc is speeding up the transition away from Russian pipeline deliveries, there will be no supplies from the bloc's former biggest supplier. "The issue is not this winter, it will be the next one, because we are not going to have Russian gas. 98% less next year, maybe nothing," Inichief Claudie Descalzi pointed out. Given the demand from China, a major importer of gas, and skyrocketing LNG prices, executives of energy companies are worried about possible social unrest, pointing out some EU countries like the Czech Republic, where households saw their energy bills increase tenfold. Russian gas supplies to the EU dropped by almost 50% since May, while exports to Japan and South Korea remained at about the same level as in 2021. The CEO of Novatek, Russia's second largest gas producer, revealed recently, "Russian supplies to Europe decreased by nearly 50 billion cubic meters of gas in the past 4 or 5 months. As of October 1st, the slump has reached 47%. CEO Leonid Mikhelson said at the Eurasian Economic Forum in Baku, adding that the EU has almost replenished the shortfall by boosting LNG consumption by 65%. According to his estimates, the EU has received a total of 43 BCM in additional volumes of gas via its LNG terminals, with 29 BCM arriving from the US. Mikkelsen suggested that the upcoming winter will be the easiest of the next three, given that the bloc has managed to build up its gas stocks. However, he warned that with restored demand in China, the global economy may need about 60 to 70 million tons of LNG in the next 2 years to offset reduced pipeline gas supplies. Mikkelsen also pointed to the lack of new major projects until 2026. In his view, global GDP will struggle to grow amid the skyrocketing energy prices, and the only way to rein in the inflation and stabilize the markets is to beef up investment in new larger-scale energy projects. And this, according to Mikkelsen, is only possible with international cooperation. Tehran Times also wrote in this regard, "Before the Ukraine war, Russia contributed to the lion's share of Europe's energy imports. However, the conflict now, in its ninth month, disrupted that partnership, and no more gas is flowing through Nord Stream 1. The energy crisis in Europe can be considered from two major aspects: the short-term effects and challenges, and the long-term impacts and solutions. although considering the condition of the union's storage facilities, which, according to the International Energy Agency, IEA, are currently 95% full, Europe might be able to pass through this year's winter, but there is a heavy price that it must pay in doing so. Businesses across Europe are not just curbing their energy use and continuing on a business-as-usual basis. They are shutting down factories, downsizing, or relocating. Europe may well be on the way to deindustrialization. The Eurozone manufacturing activity has fallen to the lowest since May 2020. The October reading for S&P Global's PMI signaled a looming recession, falling on November and being the fourth monthly reading below 50, an indication of an economic contraction. In its latest analysis of the Europe's energy crisis published on November 3rd, the IEA said that the Union could face a shortage of as much as 30 billion cubic meters, BCM, of natural gas during the next year's peak summer period for refilling its gas storage sites. In the report dubbed Never Too Early to Prepare for Next Winter, Europe's gas balance for 2023 to 2024, IEA cautions that the caution provided by current storage levels, as well as recent lower gas prices and unusually mild temperatures, should not lead to overly optimistic conclusions about the future. IEA Executive Director Fatih Birol said, "With the recent mild weather and lower gas prices, there is a danger of complacency creeping into the conversation around Europe's gas supplies, but we are by no means out of the woods yet." A look at the report shows that the European Union is going to face a great challenge in meeting its energy needs in the coming years, and considering the heavy cost of shipping gas from long distances, Iran could have been a significant contributor to the resolution of this issue.
This is Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, everyone. This is Arab English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality. Well, this is Asma. I have the honor to be your host for today's episode, and here with me I have two very dear guests, Sister Zainab and Sister Bita, and I would love them to introduce themselves.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, Sister Asma, and all the listeners. I'm really happy to be here today. I'm Zainab Sadat, and I have my MA in English Language Teaching, TEFL.
So great. And you, Sister Bita?
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. And actually, I have the pleasure to be here today with you too, my dear friends, and also our dear listeners here. It's a big pleasure for me. So I'm Bita, and I'm a medical student at Sheikh Bashir University. And also, I'm here at your service for today's discussion.
Well, in today's episode, we're going to talk about the production of movies in the realm of religious ideas. So tell me about the religious movies you've seen and they have attracted your attention.
What came to my mind was the movie Heaven is for Real.
Yes.
And now it was produced in 2014, mm-hmm. I guess. It was based on a true story mm-hmm. of a four-year-old boy called Colton Burpo, who was the son of Todd Burpo, the pastor of a church in Nebraska, in America. This 4 years old boy went through an appendix surgery, and his situation was quite dangerous and bad. That throughout the surgery, he lost his life for some seconds. And then in that interval, his soul went out of his body and he experienced death. He saw his mother asking other people to pray for her little son. He saw his father yelling at God. And he even went and visited some people he did not have any idea about. So all of these happen when the child is saved after that surgery, and he talks about the experience to his parents. He shares this experience on social media and he has an interview.
A lot of documentaries and a lot of movies has been created from different nations.
Yes, but the most famous one is this one.
Yeah, yeah.
That I'm talking about.
There's also the thing that all these movies, they have a theme, of course, but the background for it is to make people more aware of the religion they have. You know?
I'm not a person who is that much interested in films or something, but there is one special story that I'm really interested about. That is a story of Prophet Yusuf, Joseph. That is very much interesting for me because this is the story of our lives.
Yeah.
You know, there are many beautiful contents in that story, like, for example, greed, like jealousy, like many things. For example, as you know, first Prophet Yusuf saw a dream about 11 stars and the sun and the moon that was somehow so interesting in the content of being somehow metaphysical in this way. And after that, the brothers started to grow kind of jealousy in their hearts towards this brother, and they did something wrong and wrong and wrong. And also, there is a beautiful paradoxical content of the beauty of your appearance and the beauty of your soul.
Exactly.
That, you know, that beauty, that physical beauty made him go to the prison, but the thing that freed him was actually his beauty of soul and behavior.
His virtues, actually.
Yeah, exactly.
And also, there's another theme behind that TV series, which is the fact that no matter what people want, at the end, the thing that God has planned is going to happen.
Yeah, yeah.
So they wanted him dead. They wanted their brother to be dead because they were so jealous of him. But what happened in the end?
He was the most famous person in Egypt, and that was amazing, I think.
He became the king.
Yeah. And I think this is not only a historical monument or something, this is something that you have to actually be patterned on our life, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
We have to learn from these kind of stories. And these stories, I think, have the potential to actually be acted again and again. And we have to have more movies, I think,
exactly,
from these
stories.
Exactly,
yes. And there's another movie I would like to share in here.
I'm all ear.
Yes, it was Fathers 2. I'm not sure if you have seen it or not, but I recommend it too much
because
it was a very nice movie starring Mel Gibson and Mark Wahlberg. It was an amazing movie. And I guess the director was Mark Wahlberg himself. It was about a man who is trying his hand in different job, but in all of them, he was a loser. Until a time he falls in love with a girl who's Catholic, and then she goes to the church so much, and then because of her he's been forced to go to church, the process of baptism and whatever, he went through all of them, and then because of the love of a girl he started to fall for the church, and then he was coming and going so much and so much, he started to go for some sessions until a time when he actually has an accident, and then after that accident his life turned upside down. He saw the Virgin Mary telling him that you should be the follower of my son. Then after that, when he wakes up from his sickness, he comes to be studying priesthood, and then he becomes a priest. Just imagine a person who's having, he was a layman. He did not know anything. He was an ordinary man who was actually doing nothing in his life. They had a shattered family because the son of the family has been lost some years ago. So the entire family went apart because of that incident. And then at the end, he became a priest, and unbelievably, though he did not know the language, the pompous language of the priests and whatsoever, but he became a kind of a priest that was so down to earth and all the people wanted to go for him in order to share their sins and whatever they do with him, because he just gave them the advices that was more practical and a worldly language, you know. He talked to them as if he was one of them. So the guy who thought he's useless turned out to be very much worthy and valuable when he came closer to his Lord, and he became the follower, the true follower of the Jesus after what Virgin Mary asked him to. So it was a nice movie, actually. A lot of themes was behind that. And the most important one was the fact that when you get closer to the Lord, your life is not getting any easier, because there's no promise as such, but you are going to change totally. Then you see your true self more clearly. So before we get into other aspects of these movies and their production, let's go for a short break and we'll be back. Welcome back. This is Back to Reality. We're talking about movies, about religious themes, and with the idea that they want to spread some ideas on the morality or spirituality. We actually gave some examples of the movies, and I'm sure that you know already there are plenty much of movies that go with the same intention to talk about morality and to have some religious backgrounds. I would recommend you, if you want to know more about some movies working on these religious themes, then you can go and listen to Viewpoints. In there, we have a program that works on different movies, and it will go for the criticism of different aspects of the movies that are working with the morality or religious aspect. You can check the archive of IRB English Radio, parstoday.com. Now, we know that there are plenty much of movies being done about some other religions. Now, in Islamic format, we do not have that much of movies because of there haven't been so much of work. Of course, there have been some efforts, but still we have to work on it more and more. Why do we have to work on these movies at first? Let's clear this one.
There are two groups of these movies that we can make. One of them is actually especially limited to Islam or something, and the other one is somehow some questions that human beings all around the world that we have about the potential of human being's soul.
So you are making them into two groups.
Yeah, exactly.
One morality and one humanity.
Yeah, that's nice. So first of all, I think the working widely around the world, but the second group is somehow beautiful. We have many movies around the world, even from Islamic nation, about this part. But about mm-hmm. that part, I mean morality, I think, yes, we have a way to go for this road, a long way to
exactly.
go. Exactly. You know, and first of all, I think we need it. Unfortunately, religious theme or something is somehow actually risky for everybody to produce a movie without involving any of their own thoughts, you know.
Yeah.
And I think this is the main problem, that we don't go through these parts that
yeah.
much.
Yeah, that's very true, you know, because the producer of the TV series of Imam Ali alayhi salam or mm-hmm. Imam Hassan alayhi salam has once, even Imam Rida alayhi salam,
yeah.
the producer said that it was so difficult for me. The burden was so much on me that after finishing these movies, I thought that I have to take a long rest because too much of pressure I felt when the movie was going on air. You know what I
yeah,
mean?
Yeah.
So it's very much true. These movies are very much risky because they're working with the beliefs and creeds of people. You know, the creed of a nation is not something easy to play with.
Yes.
And these directors and these writers usually know the way how to work with the cords of your brain. You know what I mean?
You know, and they must be quite professional in
exactly.
that field. You
yeah.
know, an ordinary director might not be able to handle such serious matters and topics. The director has to have lots of experience in that genre.
Exactly.
Of
and
movie
they
making.
Themselves must be religious enough to know all the aspects
mm-hmm.
of the religion they're going to talk about,
mm-hmm.
its morality or
yeah.
its humanity.
Because they would reflect their
yeah.
mentality
yeah.
throughout their movies.
So right now, let's put it in here and go for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
We're talking about the production of movies in the realm of religious ideas. As I'm sure you're going to agree with me, these sort of movies, though they're very much risky and very much difficult to be created, but they have a great effect on people. And they might change some even wrong attitudes they have toward the religion or toward the morality that's been talked about.
They might affect a culture, in fact.
Exactly.
Yes, just as you said. Yes, the influence might be so wide that a huge number of people might change their attitude.
And of course, it's not just movies, you know. There are different formats of these sort of creations that would work. Like animations we have, like we have even documentaries. I've seen plenty much of documentaries that come to talk about different religion, different aspects of each religion, which is very much interesting. And also, we could have short clips and whatever.
Music, even in some
even
genres.
Even music, yes. And you know that media is helping us. Nowadays, everything is pretty much easier. But the thing is, we have to go through too much of reading and studying in order to be able to make something which is valuable, not just a piece of a work.
Yes. And so, if you allow me, I want to add something. I think because the historical part of religion is somehow more bold in the society, and most of the movies or even musics with the religious theme has somehow a historical genre too. We have to make it more practical to just interest other people in this matter, actually.
You mean that we have to bring them into modern world?
Exactly. This is what I mean.
So that we attract audience.
Yeah.
So that's all the time that we had for today's episode. We talked about movies. We know that creating a movie, producing a movie, having a good writer in order to write a good synopsis for the movie that we intend to make is going to be a hard job. It is a drudgery. It needs so much of effort. But of course, it is going to have some fruitful effects on society and on people. So I hope we might have some more of these religious movies that are going to change a nation and have effects on everyone and spread humanity and kindness everywhere. Thank you for staying with us. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabb. Let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
the limelight.
The United States of America, or as what the publication Economist has described, that this United States of America is on the path to decline. This is what experts have acknowledged and had warned years before. From its broken economy to its political division and decadent culture, there is no glimpse of hope for the United States regime to be recovered. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Tehran Times had an eye on this issue, writing, in his recent speech, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has said that the United States is moving on the path of decline. Many independent pundits and experts acknowledge that. One of the things that, I'm saying this now, some other people across the world have apparently said it too. I believe that one of the signs of America's decline is the election of people like the current and the former president, Ayatollah Khamenei said in a meeting with the students, adding, a country of 300 million plus people almost destroys itself and elects a president in the previous term, somebody like Trump, whom the world considers to be crazy. And after he was defeated, a man like this current one comes to power and, well, you know, the stories about him. This is evidence of the decline of a nation. This is evidence of a decline of a civilization. So this matters related to America. The fact that the United States is on the decline has been reiterated by many pundits and politicians, including inside the United States. On Sunday, November 6th, former President Donald Trump described the United States as a country in decline in a campaign speech in western Pennsylvania. He told supporters, if you want to stop the destruction of our country and save the American dream, then on Tuesday you must vote Republican in a giant red wave. On the other hand, President Joe Biden is now warning that America is on the path to chaos. As I stand here today, there are candidates running for every level of office in America, for governor, for Congress, for attorney general, for secretary of state, who won't commit to accepting the results of the elections they are in, Biden said, adding, this is the path to chaos in America. It's unprecedented, it's unlawful, and it is un-American. Biden also warned that democracy in America could not be taken for granted anymore. Nearly half of Americans fear their country will erupt within the next decade, The Guardian reported, citing three American political scientists who warned of another civil war breaking out in America. Look for the next civil war to take place after the 2024 election cycle, when the next wave of violence is likely to emerge, similar to the original civil war. There is too much at stake for both sides. Then, as now, the threats are existential, Christopher Sebastian Parker, professor of political science at the University of California, Santa Barbara, wrote for The Guardian, adding, America is rushing headlong into another civil war, and it's a matter of when, not if. Barbara F. Walker, an American political scientist, is of the opinion that America will continue to decline due to a variety of factors. America's democracy declined rapidly between 2016 and 2020. Since January 6, 2021, the U.S. has failed to strengthen its democracy in any way, leaving it vulnerable to continued backsliding into the middle zone, she said. Also, Guardian wrote, nearly half of Americans fear their country will erupt within the next decade. Americans are increasingly talking about civil war. In August, after the FBI raided Donald Trump's Florida home, Twitter references to civil war jumped to 3,000%. Trump supporters immediately went online, tweeting threats that a civil war would start if Trump was indicted. One account wrote, "Is it civil war o'clock yet?" Another said, "Get ready for an uprising." Lindsey Graham, a Republican senator from South Carolina, said there would be riots in the streets if Trump was indicted. Trump himself predicted that terrible things are going to happen if the temperature wasn't brought down in the country. Perhaps most troubling, Americans on both sides of the political divide increasingly state that violence is justified. In January 2022, 34% of Americans surveyed said that it was sometimes okay to use violence against the government. 7 months later, more than 40% said they believed civil war was at least somewhat likely in the next 10 years. 2 years ago, no one was talking about a second American civil war. Today, it is common. Are America's fears overblown? The most frequent question we asked following the book, How Civil Wars Start and How to Stop Them, is whether a civil war could happen again in the United States. Skeptics argue that America's government is too powerful for anyone to challenge. Others argue that secession will never happen because the country is no longer cleanly divided along geographic lines. Still others simply cannot believe that Americans would start killing one another. These beliefs, however, are based on the mistaken idea that a second civil war would look like the first. It will not. If a second civil war breaks out in the U.S., it will be a guerrilla war fought by multiple small militias spread around the country. Their targets will be civilians, mainly minority groups, opposition leaders, and federal employees. Judges will be assassinated. Democrats and moderate Republicans will be jailed on bogus charges. Black churches and synagogues bombed. Pedestrians picked off by snipers in city streets, and federal agents threatened with death should they enforce federal law. The goal will be to reduce the strength of the federal government and those who support it, while also intimidating minority groups and political opponents into submission. The U.S. is not yet in a civil war, but a 2012 declassified report by the CIA on insurgencies outlines the signs. According to the report, a country is experiencing an open insurgency when sustained violence by increasingly active extremists has come the norm. By this point, violent extremists are using sophisticated weapons such as improvised explosive devices and begin to attack vital infrastructure such as hospitals, bridges, and schools, rather than just individuals. These attacks also involve a large number of fighters, some of whom have combat experience. There is often evidence, according to the report, of insurgent penetration and subversion of the military, police, and intelligence services. In this early stage of civil war, extremists are trying to force the population to choose sides, in part by demonstrating to citizens that the government cannot keep them safe or provide basic necessities. The goal is to incite a broader civil war by denigrating the state and growing support for violent measures. Insurgency experts wondered whether January 6 would be the beginning of such a sustained series of attacks. This has not yet happened, in part because of aggressive countermeasures by the FBI. The FBI has arrested more than 700 individuals who participated in the riot, charging 225 of them with assaulting, resisting, or impeding officers or employees. Stuart Rotz, the leader of the Oath Keepers, will almost certainly go to jail for his role in helping to organize the insurrection, as will numerous other participants. But this setback is likely to be temporary. Civil war experts know that two factors put countries at high risk of civil war. The U.S. has one of these risk factors and remains dangerously close to the second. Neither risk factor has diminished since January 6. The first is ethnic factionalism. This happens when citizens in a country organize themselves into political parties based on ethnic, religious, or racial identity rather than ideology. The second is anocracy. This is when a government is neither fully democratic nor fully autocratic. It's something in between. Civil wars almost never happen in full, healthy, strong democracies. They also seldom happen in full autocracies. The violence almost always breaks out in countries in the middle, those with weak and unstable pseudo-democracies. Autocracy and anocracy plus factionalism is a dangerous mix. We also know who tends to start civil wars, especially those fought between different ethnic, religious, and racial groups. This also does not bode well for the U.S. The groups that tend to resort to violence are not the poorest groups or the most downtrodden. It's the group that had once been politically dominant but is losing power. It's the loss of political status, a sense of resentment that they are being replaced and that the identity of their country is no longer theirs. That tends to motivate these groups to organize. Today, the Republican Party and its base of white Christian voters are losing their dominant position in American politics and society as a result of demographic changes. Whites are the slowest growing demographic in the U.S. and will no longer be a majority of the population by around 2044. Their status will continue to decline as America becomes more multi-ethnic, multiracial, and multi-religious, and the result will be increasing resentment and fear at what lies ahead. The people who stormed the Capitol on January 6 believed they were saving America from this future and felt fully justified in this fight.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.